Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight, MLK Day, as the nation honors Martin Luther King Jr., the civil rights leader's son, makes the case for why Congress should pass new federal voting rights legislation.
This is fundamental to our democracy in terms of saving our democracy. It shouldn't be about making it harder for people to vote. It should be making it easier and expanding and protecting.
Then, searching for answers, authorities in the U.S. and the U.K. investigate why a British citizen held a rabbi and congregants hostage at a Texas synagogue. And safety measures, as new COVID cases drop in some parts of the country but spike in others, we ask a doctor to spell out best practices for masking and testing. All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. This has been a day for remembering the legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., but also a day of calls to action on voting rights. In Chicago, a car caravan rolled through streets in support of voting legislation now stalled in the U.S. Senate. In Washington, demonstrators marched for the same cause, and in a virtual address, Vice President Harris warned the freedom to vote is under assault.
Today, we must not be complacent or complicit. We must not give up, and we must not give in. To truly honor the legacy of the man we celebrate today, we must continue to fight for the freedom to vote, for freedom for all.
The family of Martin Luther King Jr. is at the forefront of today's efforts calling for expanded voting rights. The civil rights leader's son, Martin Luther King III, is chairman of the Drum Major Institute, and I spoke with him a short time ago. Martin Luther King III, thank you very much for joining us. You have been observing your father's birthday for virtually your entire life. You've been speaking about the commitment that he had to voting rights, to civil rights. How is this year different?
What makes this year different is we are specifically focused on delivering for voting rights. We have seen since 2021, after the insurrection, 19 states with 34 pieces of legislation that have created suppressive voting rights legislation. So our goal is to get the John Lewis bill and the For the People Voting Rights Act done. And I think that normally we're looking at issues, but this is fundamental to our democracy in terms of saving our democracy. It shouldn't be about making it harder for people to vote. It should be making it easier and expanding and protecting. And that's why we need the United States Senate to vote on these bills.
I want to play for you right now something your father said in 1965. You mentioned the Senate. He was talking about the filibuster, the rule that's an issue today. Let's listen.
I think the tragedy is that we have a Congress with a Senate that has a minority of misguided senators who will use the filibuster to keep the majority of people from even voting. They won't let the majority of senators vote. And certainly they wouldn't want the majority of people to vote because they know they do not represent the majority of the American people.
That was all those years ago. What do you think he would be saying about what's going on right now?
Well, I think first he would be greatly disappointed in the current leadership in the Senate, I don't know about particularly one side or the other, because the reality is there are enough senators there to get this done around protecting, preserving, and expanding voting rights. But he'd be very disappointed that the leadership has chosen so far not to get this done.
One of the minds you are trying to change in the Senate is that of Arizona Democrat Senator Kyrsten Sinema. I'm sure you know, on the floor of the Senate last week, she said, yes, she is for voting rights reform, but she is more concerned about the political divide in this country and deepening those divisions. What would you say to her about that?
Well, I need her to explain why she was willing to go around that provision to raise just a few weeks ago, the debt ceiling, to make sure the full faith and credit of our country didn't go in the tubes, which is very important, by the way. But yet she was willing to forego it then. She was willing to create a scenario for health care, which is good, in 2010. But when it comes to protecting the rights, the most fundamental right we have, the right to vote, it's perplexing to me. You can't say you're for something, in my judgment, and not have a pathway to make it happen.
You're referring, of course, to the Senate rule, the filibuster. You are focusing a lot of your attention on those two Democratic holdouts, Senator Sinema and Senator Manchin. But we know Republicans are opposing these changes en masse. And we heard yesterday Senator Mitt Romney say, and I'm going to quote, he said, he's speaking about advocates for change. He said they feel instead of elections being run at the state level, they should really be managed and run at the federal level. But the founders didn't have that vision in mind. What would you say to that?
So, well, the fact of the matter is when states are making it harder and restricting people's rights to vote, and embracing what we feel is like a Jim Crow mentality. This is Jim Crow 2.0 is what they're doing. Then it is the federal government is where we always turn to get relief. There used to be a preclearance provision in the Voting Rights Act. We need that preclearance provision again so that states will not mistreat people, that everyone is treated the same way. And again, we should be expanding the right to vote. And quite frankly, I'm going to go on so far and say, you know, I'm disappointed to hear some of the things. I know that Senator Romney had said that he was concerned in relationship to some of the things the president has said and he hadn't been reached out to.
Right.
But yet Senator Kaine said they've reached out across the aisle and not one Republican other than maybe the senator from Alaska had expressed some interest, but everyone else, all of them. So they are on the side, they're on the wrong side of history, in my judgment.
I want to ask you about President Biden. As you know, he's pleaded for voting rights over the last several weeks, but AME Bishop Reginald Jackson is arguing that the president was late to this game, and I'm quoting him. But South Carolina Representative James Clyburn said yesterday that given COVID, that the president's priorities have been in the right place. Who's right here?
Yeah, they're both right. I mean, that sounds strange. But anyway, in other words, the president has had a number of priorities as it relates to COVID. There's nothing probably more important than the health and safety of our nation. But there also is nothing more important than the right to vote for everyone in an unencumbered way for our nation. So I think, in a real sense, both areas are right. Congressman Clyburn is right and Bishop Jackson.
Well, Bishop Jackson went on to say that he thinks the president needs to, he put it, draw a line in the sand. He said if these senators are not going to support this top priority, then the president needs to make it clear that democracy is going to come first before their own special projects, interests, and priorities. In other words, he's talking about some kind of punishment of senators who don't go along.
Well, I think what Bishop Jackson was saying is that those who are not willing to engage in the process of democracy in fairness for all people in terms of the right to vote, then when it comes to election time again, they may not get the support that they may have gotten in the past. And I think that's very real. I think that's a realistic perception.
And just to follow on that, I know you say you are very focused on this coming vote, but what do you believe it's going to mean for this year's elections if voting rights reform does not pass?
Well, I think the biggest issue is there are a myriad of issues on the table right now. And the reason voting rights protections need to pass are to ensure that the maximum number of people can participate in the process. But if the maximum number of people are not allowed to participate in the process, it could be certainly disastrous. I mean, the president could lose the majority in both houses. Some conventional wisdom might say that already the House is lost, but the Senate could be lost as well. So, you know, none of us know any of that right now. We're looking at conventional wisdom this day, but a number of things can change.
Martin Luther King III, thank you very much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you for the opportunity.
In the day's other news, the COVID-19 death toll in the United States has passed 850,000, with the average number of daily deaths climbing sharply in the last 2 weeks. Meanwhile, China has eased its lockdown measures in Xi'an, about 75 miles from Beijing. But Beijing also reported its first case of Omicron, with the Winter Olympics less than 3 weeks away. Major U.S. airlines and cargo lines warned today of a crisis when AT&T and Verizon deploy new, faster 5G wireless internet service on Wednesday. Delta, United, and Southwest said that they need federal clearance to keep major airports operating, or air travel could be sharply reduced. There are concerns that 5G signals could interfere with airliner instruments that are used to measure the distance to the ground. A major winter storm brought heavy snow and high winds to the Northeast today, cutting power for thousands and canceling flights. Plows were out in force overnight in eastern Ohio, where some places got more than 2 feet of snow. And as day came, people in Rochester, New York, had to dig their way out. The storm migrated from the deep south after causing the deaths of at least 2 people. Australia and New Zealand sent out surveillance flights to Tonga today in the wake of an enormous undersea volcano eruption on Saturday. Communication with the South Pacific island chain remains largely cut off, but there is word of significant damage. Nick Schifrin has our report.
A blast so massive it was seen from space. Satellite imagery caught the explosion and a ball of ash billowing above and beyond the Tongan islands. Before the blast, thick plumes filled the sky, shooting up 12 miles above sea level. On Tonga, the tsunami arrived quickly. Communications are almost completely down and the death toll is unknown. But one confirmed dead, Briton Angela Glover, who ran a rescue dog charity. Her brother Nick spoke in the UK.
I haven't got the words in my vocabulary to even describe how we're feeling at the moment.
The explosion caused waves around the world. In Pacifica, California, harbors flooded. In Japan's Sakihama port, fishermen looked on as their boats sank. And in Peru, coastal areas flooded and 2 women drowned after waves swept them away. In total, around the world, the explosion affected at least 11 countries and territories.
It's a rare explosion that reaches the stratosphere, and that's what got everyone's attention.
Ed Vansky is a senior researcher with the Smithsonian's Global Volcanism Program. He says the eruption comes from a chamber of magma forcing itself through rock.
Just like in a bottle of soda, the gas that's contained in that liquid magma starts to expand. And so it reaches the surface, fragment the magma, and start an eruption. And when that hot magma hits the water expands and creates its own explosion.
A volcanic explosion that's believed to be the largest in 3 decades. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Nick Schifrin.
Remarkable pictures. In Sudan, meantime, this has been one of the deadliest days since October's military coup. Security forces in Khartoum again opened fire on protesters, killing 7 and wounding around 100 others. That makes at least 71 people killed so far in the near-daily protests. The U.S. and its Asian allies today condemn North Korea's 4th firing of ballistic missiles this month. The South Korean military says they were short-range weapons that flew not quite 240 miles, landing in the sea. The North has rejected new talks on its nuclear program until the U.S. drops sanctions. China reports that its economy grew 8% for all of last year, but slowed to only half that rate in the 4th quarter. The drop-off came as Beijing cracked down on the real estate industry's surging debt. That, in turn, triggered a slump in construction. And back in this country, Charles McGee, a Tuskegee Airman who flew combat missions in three wars, died Sunday at his home in Bethesda, Maryland. In both military and civilian life, he faced segregation and racism. But he was highly decorated. And in 2020, he received a standing ovation during President Trump's State of the Union address. Charles McGee was 102 years old. Still to come on the NewsHour, the contentious debate over changing the Senate filibuster. A doctor's take on best practices for COVID testing and masking. How a new museum celebrates and critiques the history of filmmaking, and much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
This weekend's events in Texas, where four people were taken hostage at a synagogue, has renewed concerns about potential targeting of groups and the threats of anti-Semitism. Amna Nawaz has our coverage.
After surviving more than 11 hours on Saturday, held at gunpoint in his Texas synagogue, Rabbi Charlie Citron Walker spoke today with CBS Mornings.
It was terrifying. It was overwhelming.
Sharing for the first time how he and other hostages escaped.
I threw a chair at the gunman and I headed for the door. And all three of us were able to get out without even a shot being fired.
The FBI has identified the hostage taker as Malik Faisal Akram, a 44-year-old British citizen. On Saturday morning, Akram entered Congregation Beth Israel in the Fort Worth suburb of Colleyville, taking the rabbi and three congregants hostage during a live-streamed Sabbath service. More than 200 local, state, and federal law enforcement quickly converged on the site, and hostage negotiators engaged with Akram. Reportedly heard on the live stream demanding the release of Dr. Afia Siddiqui, a Pakistani neuroscientist convicted in 2010 of trying to kill American soldiers in Afghanistan. Currently serving an 86-year sentence in a Fort Worth federal prison, Siddiqui has become a cause celeb for Islamist extremists. The synagogue standoff stretched on for hours. Around 5 p.m. Saturday, an elderly hostage was released unharmed. Around 9 p.m., the others managed to escape. Law enforcement reportedly approached the building. Shots were fired and Akram was left dead. It's unclear how he died. Later that night, the FBI provided an update.
We obviously are investigating. We'll continue to investigate the hostage taker. We'll continue to investigate his contacts. Our investigation will have global reach.
On Sunday in northwestern England, British police detained two teenagers for questioning as part of the probe. Back in the U.S., in a Sunday night statement, the FBI called the attack, quote, a terrorism-related matter in which the Jewish community was targeted. This at a time of rising anti-Semitism in America. According to the Anti-Defamation League, more than 2,000 anti-Semitic incidents were reported in 2020, the third highest year on record. In recent years, Jewish institutions nationwide have ramped up security, including training for their community. In a Sunday statement, Rabbi Citron Walker said those trainings at Congregation Beth Israel saved their lives, writing, quote, in the last hour of our hostage crisis, the gunmen became increasingly belligerent and threatening. Without the instruction we received, we would not have been prepared to act and flee when the situation presented itself. In the aftermath and as a precaution, an increase in security at Jewish institutions across America.
For more on how this latest anti-Semitic attack is impacting Jewish communities and what it says about the state of hate more broadly, I'm joined by Jonathan Greenblatt. He is the CEO of the Anti-Defamation League and the author of a new book called It Could Happen Here, Why America is Tipping from Hate to the Unthinkable and How We Can Stop It. Jonathan, welcome back to the NewsHour. Thank you for being here. The rabbi saying that the only reason they all made it out alive was because of trainings, of the idea that they had prepared for something that it could potentially happen to them was just one of the most revealing moments in the last day or so. And I have to ask you, how widespread is that fear in Jewish communities that it could happen to them too?
Well, I'll just start off by saying how grateful we are that the rabbi and the other hostages were rescued safely. His heroism clearly, saved the day, as well as the brave work of law enforcement, particularly the FBI. That being said, I was also humbled that the rabbi mentioned specifically that training from the FBI and the ADL helped save their lives. Jews across the country are terrified in this moment. As you and I have talked about before on this program, we've seen Jews attacked at JCCs, synagogues, kosher supermarkets. Again, you know, what happened just this weekend. They are alarmed, and there is so much anxiety right now to see our sacred spaces under siege in this way. The reality is, as the rabbi said, indeed, clergy across the country who want to study Torah end up having to learn tactical maneuvers because of evil people with anti-Semitic ideas who are willing to bring violence into our communities. The data doesn't lie, despite the fact that Jews are less than 2% of the US population. 60% of the faith-oriented hate crimes target Jewish communities across the country. So they are feeling vulnerable right now to violence. They are worried. And so all of us are just in a state of shock.
Jonathan, you and I have talked about these rising numbers before. A number of people report on them again and again, and yet there are a lot of people out there who don't believe this is happening. Your colleagues at the ADL wrote about the reaction online in very extremist circles, we should note, ranging from Islamist extremists sort of hailing this, but also a bunch of people sort of denying that it happened or calling it a staged or a fake attack that they say Jewish people are using to get sympathy. How where does that come from? And also, has that kind of denialism been getting worse?
It's stunning and sickening, but not surprising. If you were to ask me, why are we living in this moment? I think social media, which has brought this unfettered flow of sewage from the margins into the mainstream, has a lot to do with it. The demonization of Jews, of Israel, of Zionism, makes all Jews feel literally vulnerable and under a kind of siege. And the failure of the big platforms to do anything, but also, honestly, the failure of people in public life to speak out clearly and consistently on both sides of the aisle. People on the left, people on the right, they weaponize these claims. And honestly, Jews get caught in the middle. So I do think as our country is more polarized, say, than it's been in literally generations, you're seeing this play out more and more, where anti-Semitism is amplified and all kinds of hate are on the rise. And again, unfortunately, there's simply a real history and there's real world violence that occurs when this kind of rhetoric just explodes all over our platforms in the public conversation.
Which brings me to your book title, because that's a worry I think a lot of people have, the idea of tipping from hate to the unthinkable. What are you worried that we're heading towards, and how do we keep from going there?
Well, look, I mean, the unthinkable is I would go to shul on a Saturday morning and end up held hostage for 12 hours. The unthinkable is that my wife would go to a kosher supermarket and suddenly she could be shot and killed by an evil black Hebrew Israelite. The unthinkable is that a college town like Charlottesville could be marched upon by white supremacists out in the open. And today people still deny what happened just a year ago. Look, I'm the grandson of a Holocaust survivor from Germany, Amna, who never could have imagined that the only country he had ever known would turn on him, destroy everything that he loved, and slaughter almost his entire family and friends. And I'm the husband of a political refugee from Iran, whose family, the only country they had ever known, it turned on them after the Islamic Revolution, destroyed everything that they loved, and they fled for their lives. So today, in a moment where we have to have the kind of security at our synagogues that you associate with Fort Knox, we're moving toward the unthinkable, and I think it's time all of us realize this anti-Semitism, Amna, it's not a Jewish problem, it's an American problem. This is a failure of our democracy, and we need to take it that seriously.
Jonathan Greenblatt, CEO of the Anti-Defamation League, thank you for speaking with such clarity. We really appreciate you being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
As the Senate returns tomorrow to take up legislation on voting rights, there is one major roadblock for Democrats. Majority Leader Chuck Schumer doesn't have the votes to pass it in an evenly divided chamber. That has led to renewed talk of reforming the Senate's rules. Lisa Desjardins picks it up from there.
Judy, it's called the filibuster, the right of senators to derail votes, in theory, with infinite debate. And it's why there is a 60-vote threshold for most Senate bills. Long speeches have always been part of the Senate, but requiring a supermajority vote to end them, that came in 1917, and it has defined the modern Senate. It has changed some with a lower threshold and 161 at least workarounds in its first 100 years. Today, all 50 Senate Democrats agree on voting rights reforms, but they do not agree on whether to change the Senate's rules to pass them. For more on the debate over the filibuster, we turn to Adam Gentleson, the executive director of Battleborne Collective, a progressive communications firm, and former advisor to Democratic Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid. And Brian Darling, senior advisor to Navigators Global, a conservative communications firm, and former advisor to Republican Senator Rand Paul. Gentlemen, thank you. Let me just jump right into this important debate. Adam, why should the filibuster change?
Well, the filibuster, Lisa, as you said, has changed a lot over the years. And in today's Senate, it has gone from what most Americans think of when they think of the filibuster, when they think of perhaps Jimmy Stewart standing on the Senate floor giving a long speech, into a more refined tool of obstruction that simply allows a minority of senators who may represent as little as a quarter of the population to block the majority from acting on centrist common sense policies. So if the filibuster ever served a useful purpose, it is mutated far beyond what the framers ever envisioned and become a tool purely for obstruction. I think that's what you're seeing in the Senate today. And that is why it needs to either be reformed dramatically or gotten rid of altogether.
Brian, to Adam's point there, the filibuster, the supermajority, is not in the Constitution. Why should it stand?
Well, the Senate serves a very important function. It was created by our founders to represent the states. And we live in a republic, a democratic republic. And over the years, the Senate has had a tradition of extended debate. It's something called the filibuster. It serves to keep the Senate in its function as a deliberative body, a body that promotes independence and moderation and free speech. And as you know, Democrats and Republicans have both shifted talking points on this. But I think that most people who have served in the Senate and respect the Senate love the idea of extended debate, like the idea of having senators have the opportunity to slow the whole process down and let the American people get involved in the legislative process.
Adam, what about Brian's point there, that this preserves the Senate as a place of thoughtful, meaningful debate?
I think that's a nice theory, but in practice, that's not how it works at all. If anybody were to turn on C-SPAN 2 any day of the week or to go to the Senate, they would see that's not what happens. Nobody is ever on the Senate floor debating. Nobody is ever there having a thoughtful exchange of ideas. What you would see is an empty, paralyzed chamber, and that is because of the filibuster. If the filibuster ever did serve a useful purpose, it was to foster that kind of debate, and that's why I favor a return to the talking filibuster, the Jimmy Stewart-style filibuster where senators are actually on the floor. But what the framers intended, to Brian's point about the Senate being a place to protect minority input, they did believe it should be a place to protect minority input, but they also believed that there was a careful balance to strike between protecting minority input and allowing the minority to block the majority altogether. And they were very clear, in no uncertain terms, that they did not believe that a minority of senators should have the ability to block the majority. They thought the minority should be able to debate, have input, as Brian said, to bring the public into the discussion, and that could go on for days, weeks, even months sometimes. But when push came to shove, at the end of the day, the issue at hand was supposed to come up for a simple majority vote, as it did for 200 years in the Senate, and that's what the framers believe. What we have today is a Senate where the filibuster has tipped it from deliberation into dysfunction. And that's why we need to go back to the traditions of the past, where you have senators actually debating instead of just allowing a minority of senators to block whatever the majority wants to do with barely even raising a finger and certainly never having to go to the Senate floor to debate the issue.
Brian, I want to get to that idea of how the Senate functions, which is really how our whole government functions, and the filibuster. You know, let's look at a graphic over how the filibuster has been used, measured by cloture votes. You can see that its use has really exploded in the past couple of decades. But at that same time, so has partisanship. The increased use of the filibuster hasn't made people be more bipartisan. How do you answer that idea that the Senate is dysfunctional and that the filibuster as a political tool is part of it?
Well, I think we all agree that there's dysfunction in the Senate. There's dysfunction in Congress as a whole. And I don't think changing the rules is going to solve that problem. You look at the Biden administration, they've actually passed significant legislation. They passed a bipartisan infrastructure bill. They passed a COVID relief package early in the Biden presidency, and they also hiked the debt limit. So they have passed significant pieces of legislation. They've extended funding for the government through a continuing resolution. So we can say that the Senate is broken, but I think the problem is that many want to put through legislation. It's very controversial. It's highly partisan, like this voting reform bill. And that's something that even it doesn't appear that all Democrats are on board with changing the rules to do that.
Brian, it seems like everyone here agrees that there's a problem in how Congress is working, that it's broken. I know you feel that way, but would you support something like a talking filibuster that Adam's talking about, some kind of reform?
I think that if senators were to take the floor and be forced to give speeches and hold the floor, I might support that, but I don't support it being done the way it's being done now. But it should be a bipartisan change. It shouldn't be done by throwing the rules out the window and claiming that they're unconstitutional.
Adam, one quick last question for you. Some Democrats are nervous. If you do this, Democrats will actually be harmed when Republicans, as often happens, Senate changes hands, Republicans take over, that Democrats would regret this change.
Given the history here, Mitch McConnell, when he was majority leader under President Trump, was very quick to do away with the filibuster to confirm Supreme Court nominees. So the first time it became an issue for him, he did away with it with a flick of his wrist. Mitch McConnell, some may also recall, also led the fight to end the filibuster under President George W. Bush in 2005. So I think relying on Mitch McConnell and Senate Republicans to keep the filibuster in place when it no longer serves their advantage is not a smart strategy for Democrats.
Adam Gentleson, Brian Darling, a very important debate and good thoughts from both of you. Thank you.
Thank you.
With or without the filibuster, there is no clear path to passing voting rights in the Senate right now, with the battle lines between Democrats and Republicans firmly drawn. Here to assess the politics on both sides of the debate, our Politics Monday team, Amy Walter of the Cook Political Report with Amy Walter, and Tamara Keith of NPR. Very good to see both of you. Thank you for joining us. Amy, I'm going to start with you. We just heard Lisa's discussion just now of the filibuster debate about it. However you look at it, the prospects don't look good, I think, to put it mildly, on voting rights with the filibuster or without the filibuster. People are asking, a number of people are asking, why go ahead with this to the Democrats when the prospects look so dim? Yesterday, we heard Congressman Jim Clyburn of South Carolina say on one of the Sunday shows, on several of the Sunday shows, the reason we need to go ahead is we need to know where you stand. Are you with us or are you against us? What about that line of thinking on the part of the Democrats, Amy?
Well, that's right. And Judy, there's been so much for these last few months. Democrats just seem to be running in place. And the issue is as much about trying to do work within their own party rather than trying to get a bipartisan coalition together. Joe Manchin's been at the center of a lot of this with the Build Back Better plan, but so has Kyrsten Sinema, the senator from Arizona, who took to the Senate floor the other day to say, nope, I'm not gonna support overturning the filibuster as it stands right now. And so putting people on the record, Judy, you're right, it in some ways keeps the focus on the intra-party fighting, which is Democrats can't seem to get their act together, and they didn't pass this in part because Democrats couldn't agree. But it also allows Democrats to move forward, to say, we're going to take a vote, we get people lined up on that vote, and then we go and everybody knows where everybody stands, and we see where we can get later on, which at this point, even though it doesn't seem like these bills are going to pass, reporting coming out suggesting that there may be some bipartisan agreement on changing this Electoral Count Act of 1887, which would prevent something like a vice president being able to say, go in and say that he has authority to overturn electoral votes.
So to Tam, I mean, pretty much the same question. I mean, there is an alternative out there, but Democrats are saying, most Democrats are saying, that's a distraction. We need to focus first on voting rights, but they don't have the votes. The argument, you know, is, as we heard from Jim Clyburn, we need to know whose side you're on, which side are you on. That's the Democrats' calculus, but there's a risk in that.
Certainly. And Vice President Harris today was asked about this as well and essentially said, there are 100 senators in the Senate, and I'm not letting any of them off the hook, but in particular, Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin. Part of what's going on here is that Democrats are under incredible pressure from key parts of their base to do something about this. When President Biden and Vice President Harris went to Georgia to give remarks to push for this voting rights legislation, activists, voting rights activists who are a huge, you know, have a strong hold in Georgia and are very significant in Georgia, refused to show up, many of them, saying that words weren't enough. They needed a plan. And the challenge, though, is that it's really hard to have a plan when, as President Biden has said, with 50 senators, with 50 Democratic senators, every single one of them is a president. Every single one of them has the power to tank the agenda or to tank what the president wants. And so the math is just a real problem for President Biden, for key parts of his base, and for many Democrats who want to do this.
And for Democrats, Amy, for those Democrats who are in swing states or swing districts, if you're a congressman, but a member of Congress, but if you're a member of the Senate and you're in a tough race, this vote is one that will be remembered.
That's exactly where I was going, is to Arizona, right? We talk so much about Senator Sinema, but there's somebody else in Arizona, another Democrat, Mark Kelly. He's up for re-election this year. He has been very quiet about the filibuster and what he would do if that were brought up for a vote. Now, he has a very difficult choice in front of him. If he doesn't go along with Sinema's perspective on the filibuster, if he votes to overturn the filibuster for this voting rights bill, Republicans in the state are going to make the case in this election that this guy isn't so independent. He says he's an independent. He went against our Democratic senator, Kyrsten Sinema, and sided with the liberals in Washington. You can already hear the campaign ads. If he chooses to side with Sinema, then to Tam's point about the progressive community, both the energy and the money coming to him are going to get cut off. So he's probably the one in the toughest position right now to have this vote on the record.
Yeah, Tam, this is a year when it's all about the election.
Yes, because guess what? It's 2022 now. We are officially in the midterm election year. And, you know, you have Senator Kelly, who potentially has this very difficult choice. You have Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, who doesn't want a primary either. So you have a lot of competing interests. And you also have from Democrats a legitimate concern that anything they don't get done this year and relatively early this year is going to get completely overtaken by election year politics. And then if they lose the House, or, you know, certainly if they lose the House, which seems likely given all the retirements that have been announced, then they're not going to be able to do it again in 2023.
And just quickly, to speaking of Arizona, Amy, and speaking of election, former President Trump was in Arizona over the weekend talking to his fans, thousands of them, repeating the same mistruths about the election, saying he won. And Amy, a lot of conspiracy theories thrown around, people in the crowd talking about John F. Kennedy coming back, John F. Kennedy Jr. I mean, it gets to fantasy land, doesn't it?
Well, it does. And the real worry, Judy, that I think we all have is not simply that, you know, people are discussing these theories, but that in reality, majorities of voters, when an election happens, don't trust the outcome. And that is more problematic. Now, look, the good news from 2020 was we had thousands and thousands of local elected officials, people whose names we'll never know, who stood there in the breach and said, my job is to be a nonpartisan. I count the votes. I'm not here to cheer for one party or the other, put a thumb on the scale. They are still there, but undermined by this kind of language is, and it's very, very dangerous.
And Tam, we just have a few seconds to put a button on it.
Yeah, well, the former president knows some of their names now and is trying to get them replaced by people who are loyalists to him. And that's part of what that rally was about in Arizona, was promoting candidates who he has endorsed for elections this coming year.
We are going to leave it there. There are a few weeks left to talk about this year's elections. We're going to take advantage of that. Tamara Keith, Amy Walter, thank you both.
You're welcome.
A shortage of COVID testing has been a major problem across the country. Beginning this Wednesday, people will be able to order free at-home rapid tests from the government. Any individual or family will be able to get four tests by going to the website covidtest.gov. That news is welcome, but many people have concerns about those tests and other guidance that's being given right now. Nicole Ellis looks at some of these key questions.
Surging COVID cases from the Omicron variant have made it difficult for all of us to navigate our everyday lives. And it's creating more questions around vaccines, testing, and masks. To get some clarity around this, I'm joined by Dr. Payal Patel, an infectious disease physician at the University of Michigan. I want to start with testing. What is the current CDC guidance around getting tested for COVID?
What I would say is there are a couple of tests out there. You've probably heard at this point about antigen versus PCR. I think if you can get a hand on either of those tests and follow the guidance about whether you need to be tested, and most of the time, if you're asking yourself this question, the answer is yes, then I think you can go from there. And I wouldn't worry about which one it is if you can get your hand on a test.
The Biden administration is promising 500 million at-home tests free to Americans, but they're also known to be a little less accurate than PCR tests. So how does the two work together and what's their purpose?
The antigen test is a little bit different than the PCR test, the way that they kind of detect infection in your body. And the PCR test can be what we call more sensitive. Now, at the same time, that's a good thing, but that can be an interesting thing if after 14 days, your PCR test is still positive. It's not going to exactly tell you when you got infected. And so that can sometimes be the difference between the two tests. I will say, if you have a positive test at all, I would believe it, and it's not likely to be a false positive.
Some public health experts say that rapid tests are very good at telling you whether or not you are viral or contagious right now. How accurate is that? And is there a correlation between getting a positive test and whether or not you're contagious?
What is really difficult about COVID is that often you are the most contagious before you have symptoms. So that is part of the reason that we're seeing so much spread of the infection right now. So I'd keep that in mind. And if you do start having symptoms, I do think it's a good idea to get tested. And we're noticing, especially with Omicron, some research shows that your first test may be negative. So it does make sense if you have that test at home to test again, especially if you're having symptoms. Now, at the end of when you're, you know, you've had symptoms for 5 or 10 days, you've gotten better, the tests are not going to help you know if you're contagious anymore. And that's the hard part of testing.
The CDC recommends that we wear masks in public indoor spaces. Can you explain a little bit about why that is and what we should do?
You know, it's been 2 years since this all started, and there has been chance for people to start studying, okay, what kind of masks really hold up well against this infection? And the research really shows that cloth masks are inferior. They're not as good as surgical masks or something higher than that, such as an N95 or a K94. at the end of the day, what's really important is if you can hold your mask on, keep it on, not take it off, you know, it's comfortable to you. So what I would say is try to get a mask that works for you. If it can be surgical mask or something more infiltrative than that, such as a K95 or an N94, that would be best. But at this point, it's probably time to put away the cloth masks.
For 2 years now, we've been in anticipation of one day not having to worry about this. Will that day ever come? Will we ever be at a point where we don't have to worry about coronavirus or have to live under these very complicated, confusing circumstances?
What's probably going to happen as more people in the United States and in the world really get vaccinated, we will start to build up an immunity and the virus will become less strong and become one of the viruses in our cadre of millions of viruses that we see. It will take a while, but I think taking it step by step, and that comes with becoming vaccinated, can really help how we see, think about the next few months.
Dr. Payal Patel, infectious disease physician at the University of Michigan, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me today.
And you can watch an extended version of Nicole's question and answer session with Dr. Patel online. That's at pbs.org/newshour. The Academy of Motion Pictures is best known as the organization that hands out Oscars, and for the controversy in recent years about the lack of diversity in its ranks and awards. Now, the organization has opened a new museum in Los Angeles, said to be the largest in North America, devoted to the art of filmmaking. Jeffrey Brown took a tour with one of its leaders for our Arts and Culture series, Canvas.
It's a museum of the movies, so Orson Welles and Citizen Kane, R2-D2 from Star Wars, and, of course, The Wizard of Oz and Dorothy's Ruby Slippers. But these days, more than a greatest hits approach is required of cultural institutions of all kinds, including this one. Film historian Jacqueline Stewart.
You know, some people really like the term the magic of cinema. I prefer the term the power of cinema, because I think that's where we can really look at not just what happens to us on an emotional level, but think about that power as a kind of cultural power and political power.
Stewart is author and editor of books exploring film history, a professor at the University of Chicago.
And thanks for spending the night with us here on Turner Classic Movies.
And since 2019, host of Silent Sunday Nights on the Turner Classic Movies Network, presenting and discussing silent films. She's also a newly minted MacArthur Fellow, the so-called Genius Award. Her view, you can love an art form through critiquing it, a lesson she learned in her Chicago childhood watching films with an aunt.
And there were always these moments when, like, a maid would show up, or white people are having a conversation on a train and there's kind of a porter on the side. And our eye would go to those people, and then I would become curious about that actor, not just the character they were playing, but what was it like for them to be on the set in that way?
Now Stewart has a new role that allows her to present some of the stories behind what we see on screen. She's Chief Artistic and Programming Officer of the new Academy Museum of Motion Pictures in Los Angeles. Outside, a design by architect Renzo Piano that encompasses the former May Company building, itself considered an architectural landmark from 1939. Inside, four floors of permanent and temporary exhibitions, with rooms dedicated to filmmakers like Pedro Almodovar and Spike Lee, one on early cinema history, and special emphasis on the various movie crafts, costumes, animation, editing, and more. The labor that goes into a film and is so important to Stewart.
I used to get really annoyed when my students would leave a class screening as the credits were rolling, because to me, that was kind of a slap in the face of all these people who had worked on the film. It's typical. We walk out of the movie while the credits are rolling.
Sometimes the lights go on.
Yes, sometimes. The movie is over.
Yeah.
But I think that there is something absolutely essential about recognizing people's labor. Mm. That's not just true of filmmaking, it's true of everything that we do. And so I think part of what this museum is doing is it's exposing creative labor.
It's also aiming to expose something else, what's been missing from the picture. In at least one case, not on view in a room of Oscar statues, literally missing. In 1940, Hattie McDaniel became the first African-American to win an Oscar for her role as Mammy in Gone with the Wind. Later, though, her plaque, as they were then for supporting roles, went missing. The museum presents an empty case.
And what is it showing to you?
Well, the way she was treated at the Oscar ceremony, she was segregated in that space. The way that she was treated on the set of Gone with the Wind, the way that so many black actors were relegated to servant roles or minimal roles, unrealistic roles. This, for me, I think for all of us at the museum, is a way of recognizing not just Hattie McDaniel's experience, but all of the absences in film history that are based on racial segregation.
You're about to see one of the most enduringly popular films of all time, Gone with the Wind.
Gone with the Wind, of course, was controversial then and now for its romanticizing of slavery in the South. In 2020, Stewart provided an introduction to a new release of the film.
And the film's treatment of this world through a lens of nostalgia denies the horrors of slavery, as well as its legacies of racial inequality.
She argues for recontextualizing such films rather than taking them out of circulation. The Academy Museum takes that approach as well. It adds to the canon in places, for example, highlighting the work of Oscar Michaud, an early successful black filmmaker.
We even have here makeup cases that are marked as black, minstrel, light Egyptian, Chinese.
Chinese, yeah.
It also displays makeup kits from the era of blackface.
This, for us, is a really powerful way of recognizing that the industry itself knew what it was doing, and that it wasn't incidental or lighthearted, but actually these tools were crafted.
In more recent years, the Academy of Motion Pictures has been the target of the hashtag OscarSoWhite campaign and criticized for the lack of diversity in its membership. Jacqueline Stewart thinks the new museum has a role to play.
As much as I'm excited about young people coming to this museum and being inspired, and as much as I'm excited about people who feel that they haven't been represented in museums or represented in films, can come here and see themselves reflected in various ways, I'm also really excited about filmmakers, about Academy members coming here, you know, to think about how to diversify their fields, how to be mentors to people who are not historically represented in these areas. I think that that would be a real achievement, and I do think that there is a really strong feeling among many Academy members that this museum can do that kind of work.
Stewart sees the MacArthur Grant as recognition of her own work to study, critique, and change how we watch the movies. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Jeffrey Brown at the Academy Museum of Motion Pictures in Los Angeles.
And on the NewsHour online, a potential eviction crisis looms in New Orleans, where renters have already been hit hard by the pandemic and by Hurricane Ida. You can read that story at pbs.org/newshour. And that's the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and again here tomorrow evening. For all of us at the PBS NewsHour, thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.